The following programming is sponsored by Dr. Joseph Fallon Jr. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect the views of this station, its management, or Beasley Media Group.
It's time once again to get inside the world of medicine as prominent endocrinologist Dr. Joseph J. Fallon Jr. brings you Inside Medicine. Stay tuned for interviews with eminent medical specialists and receive vital information about your health. Now, here is Dr. Joseph J. Fallon Jr. with another edition of Inside Medicine.
Good morning, Philadelphia. Dr. Joe Fallon from Rowan University here today, and we have an outstanding guest. That is going to be Dr. Suzanne Schenck. Dr. Schenck is part of the Rowan School of Internal Medicine. She is an excellent internist, and you're going to learn a lot. I do want to point out that there have been a number of positive things. Let me just give a few quotes. The critical ingredient is getting off your butt and doing something. It's as simple as that. A lot of people have ideas, but there are a few who decide to do something about them now. Not tomorrow, not next week, but today. The true entrepreneur is a doer, not a dreamer. That's Nolan Bushnell, founder of Atari and Chuck E. Cheese's. A second interesting item is from Jessica Alba. Being a woman in business doesn't come without challenges. My advice, surround yourself with other supportive women that encourage you, share ideas, and get you motivated. Jessica Alba, actress and founder of The Honest Company. Finally, Queen Elizabeth. Grief is the price we pay for love. Closing line of the Queen's message at the New York City after the attack on September 11th. I do want to point out that the FDA approved a new drug, Amylyx, for Lou Gehrig's disease, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. I can say I saw a patient who was told his diagnosis in the hospital many years ago, and of course the individual was very sharp, knew what that meant. But Lou Gehrig died in 1941 at 37. A new drug was put on the market. This drug combines two drugs. It's not a cure for the disease, but generates a significant impact on progression and survival. Progress in medicine moves forward. Finally, we see an upside in healthcare for one of the Tony DeSpirito of BlackRock. So things are getting better. To be successful, you must get results. To be significant, you must help others get results. And that brings me to introduce Susan Schenck, who is one of the best internists in the Philadelphia marketplace. She works out of Rowan School of Internal Medicine. And Susan, thank you for coming on the show for Inside Medicine today.
Good morning, Joe. Thank you for inviting me. It's a privilege to be on your show.
Oh, thank you. As a primary care physician, preventive health measures are an important part of your practice and every doctor's practice. There has been a number of changes in the recommendations in the past few years. What would you like to educate our audience about? And let me just start off with an initial question. What are the sources you rely on for the appropriate screening test?
As an internist, I use the ACP, or American College of Physician guidelines. I also look at the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force guidelines. I review data from the CDC and their guidelines. I like to use the National Cancer Institute, which is part of NIH. I also look at the different subspecialty guidelines. And I periodically like to review the guidelines from Canada and Europe. It gives me a little bit of an insight of what other countries and experts looking at this data decide is appropriate or not.
I can see why you're an A to Z internist. And the answer is when you do your homework before you see patients, before you get to work every day, and Rowan University thanks you. So how can my patients, i.e. your patients, find out what screening tests are recommended for them to make sure that they live well and to the end of whatever God chosen for them?
So under the health.gov website, there is something called a My Health Finder tool, and it's a really fun thing to do. You go into health.gov/MyHealthFinder, all one word, and you can put in your age and your sex, and it'll give you a whole list of recommendations of what's appropriate for your age. You can then click on the different aspects that come up and further investigate the information. It's a really, really clever tool, and it's the level of the information is easy to understand.
So can you give that website out again, please?
Yes. health.gov, which is G-O-V, backslash My Health Finder, all one word.
Fantastic. So the U.S. Preventive Service Task Force grades preventive services. What do the grades mean?
They have four grades. They have a grade A, B, C, and D. And what they do is they look at the data to try to determine what the benefit risk ratio is for the different tests that we're doing. And a grade A means that there's high certainty when they look at the data that there's net benefit to having that screening test done or for taking a medication in some instances. A level B means that there is high certainty that there's benefit, there's moderate certainty about the benefit of the test. And if you get a grade C, it means that you really need to discuss with your doctor what the risk-benefit ratio of a test is. And if they give it a grade D, it means that they think that there's actually more harm than benefit to getting the test done.
So I guess what you're saying is this is very scientific, and what they want, that when you do a study, one study can't ever really 100% in most cases, you know, discern what a physician or a patient should do. So you're saying is that they give this gradation thing so that you have higher confidence if it's an A and going downward, and if you get to a D, it's a D.
I think also it points out that sometimes these are conversations we need to have with our physicians in order to determine what our individual risk benefit is, because those task forces look at population data. And the other thing is that these recommendations are best based on people being average risk, and we see patients, you and I, on a daily basis who are high risk or maybe even, you know, extremely high risk. So these recommendations don't necessarily pertain to them.
Okay, so my opinion is that it's nice for the patient to do their own homework, come on in, and then discuss it with their physician, just because that the physician is more used to dealing with these recommendations, but they certainly do get you around first and second base. Would that be a summation that's okay with you?
I agree with that.
Okay. So what are the features of a good screening test? Because now you're talking about how somebody put that to print.
Yeah, so one of the things about screening tests is that most of these screening tests have a risk and a benefit to them, and some screening tests.
Susan?
I'm sorry. Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
So some screening tests can have side effects, like colonoscopies, for instance. You can tear the inside lining of the colon. When we're looking at a screening test, we want it to give us the maximum amount of benefit with the least amount of risk. And the things that when we're looking at tests, we also want to make sure that we're not ordering tests that are looking for, we're trying to figure out what, we're actually trying to reduce death in cancer screening, for instance. So we're not
can you give
looking,
me an exa- how about, Suzanne, can you give me an example? How about colon cancer? Because that might help serve as a good example.
So when we're looking at colon cancer screening, what we want to look at is, we wouldn't do a colonoscopy, for instance, in necessarily a teenager to screen for colon cancer, because we're looking at a group of, we want to look at the group of patients that are at high risk. So you're looking at a test that's going to give you, that's going to allow you to detect a cancer early enough that you can prevent the side effects of the cancer, but you also want to make sure that you're not diagnosing a cancer too early in a patient who might die from something else before the cancer would kill them. So it's important when we're looking at these tests. I know a lot of my patients think, oh, I just want to find out whether I have the cancer or not. It turns out that it's a little bit more complicated than that, that we actually want to catch the cancer at a stage that's early enough that it's going to benefit your overall health.
Got it. So benefit. So is there anything special that one does for colon cancer?
So right now the recommendations for colon cancer have changed. We used to recommend that screening start at age 50 and go all the way to 75. They have now, that is still a grade A recommendation by the USPSTF, so the United States Preventive Service Task Force. They have now added as a grade B, which is recommended, but the benefits are not as clear. They have recommended starting screening at age 45 to 50 as well. And when we look at colon cancer screening, it depends on the test that we order when we're looking for that. So if we're just doing the old guaiac stools that we used to do, or the fecal occult blood test, those are recommended that you do those every year. Most people aren't doing them anymore. Most people are now doing what is called a DNA fit test, which is something like the Cologuard test that you get. Those tests are recommended that you do every 1 to 3 years. There are also recommendations in terms of doing, you can do a CT colonography, or you can do a flexible sigmoidoscopy. And those are recommended to be done approximately every 5 years. If you have a normal colonoscopy, or if you have a flexible sigmoidoscopy, which you do along with FIT testing, that can be done every 10 years.
Okay, so to an extent, there's also a bit of what you call invasiveness to the more aggressive testing, but sometimes that's what it takes, and a lot of people argue like Cologuard. The problem with Cologuard is, yes, you might pick up the cancer, but on the other hand, if somebody had a colonoscopy, the doctor would have taken out the polyps that would have become cancer. So it's really a tough call, and it sounds to me like the patient really has to discuss it with their family doctor or internist like yourself, which is the best test for them.
And obviously, if someone's extremely ill, getting a colonoscopy is something that can be high risk for them, and therefore the benefit of getting that test done to protect you from a colon cancer that might, if you're catching a polyp and it takes a while for it to become a cancer, you might actually be doing more harm in some patients who are high risk in getting a colonoscopy.
Discuss the testing with your doctor.
Yes.
So let's move forward. What about features of a good screening test? What makes you as an internist go for the test or advise the test because you want the patient to live as long and as well as they can?
So I'm looking for a test that helps me get the diagnosis before they have symptoms so that hopefully I can take care of the condition when it's less invasive, less likely to cause severe medical problems. But I also want to balance that with the risk of the procedure and the test. So the less invasive, the less harmful the test is, the better that test is for me. I'm also looking for tests where I don't have a lot of false positives or false negatives. So that means so when we order tests as physicians, for every test that we order, there are some of them that say that a patient doesn't have a condition, but in fact they do. It isn't seen on the test or it gets missed somehow. And so we want those to be minimized in a good screening test. We also don't want the screening test to show findings like a breast mass that isn't cancer on a regular basis, so that we're putting patients through biopsies and the stress of the fear of cancer and those kinds of aspects of a test.
Got it. So basically you're trying to go for safety, but go for diagnostic acumen to make sure that your patient lives longer or better.
Right.
So which services or medications are graded as having high certainty of substantial benefit, such as mammograms, I guess, et cetera, whatever?
Yes, so this was interesting. I went through the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force, and the things that they give a grade A to is screening for syphilis in adults and adolescents, colorectal cancer screening, hypertension screening, tobacco smoking cessation in adults, hepatitis B screening in pregnant women, HIV screening, and then pre-exposure prophylaxis for HIV. So if you're someone who's a high-risk behavior, taking a medication to prevent getting the infection, HIV infection is recommended. Syphilis screening in pregnant women, cervical cancer screening, and folic acid in women who are women who are potentially going to be pregnant or having children to prevent neural tube defects, and also screening for Rh incompatibility in pregnant women.
So there's a lot to screen for. So that's why the internist, you must have a big checklist up on your desk when these people come in. I'm sure you turn it over so fast that you don't need the list. But I have to say this, that I had a patient recently who was in three different hospitals who basically finally presented with an inability to walk. And actually the neurologist came in and said, yes, you've got tertiary syphilis. And I'll be honest with you, I've done a lot of syphilis tests, but I've never came back positive. And here was my patient in the hospital with an inability to walk who had tertiary syphilis. So it's just incredible. You would have hoped that, you know, that screening test would have come up earlier and the patient would have been treated, you know, much earlier. So tough call. So give me your two bits on that.
So the thing that was interesting is that that's one of the updated guidelines is the syphilis testing. And I know that we do that regularly, and then it seems to kind of go out of fashion, I'm going to say, and then we don't do it as much. And that's something that I noticed that going through these guidelines helps me remember to go back and do some of those things, like looking for syphilis. Now, the recommendation is to do it in people who are at high risk, and sometimes you don't get that information from people, and sometimes they don't know they were high risk is the other problem.
Gotcha. So which services or medications are graded as having high certainty of substantial benefit? So I would assume, in this case, if you're the one with the syphilis, you want it to be a high grade, but what are the ones that you have to, you know, kind of push on the patient just to make sure that nothing big is missed?
So the take-home for me was the colorectal cancer screening is highly recommended. Cervical cancer screening is highly recommended. Screening for hypertension and talking about tobacco cessation, those are really, really important. And then certain sexually transmitted diseases like HIV and syphilis we should be looking for on a regular basis. And then for those of us who are dealing with women of childbearing age, you know, making sure that they're taking adequate folate and that we're looking for our Rh incompatibility.
So I find that one thing that's really interesting in our office is that we had some automatic blood pressure cuffs. And I frequently get asked, you know, by the staff, Dr. Fallon, can you recheck, you know, how you do the blood pressure? And we had a cardiologist on years ago from D.C., and basically he stressed the need to make sure the patient's feet are on the floor, make sure that their arm is resting, you know, on a table or an armchair type of thing, and then do the blood pressure. So it's very interesting to me that the automatic blood pressure cuffs, I think we ruled them out at Rowan after seeing how many false pluses and negatives we had. Your opinion about blood pressure taking?
So I think it's really important how we take blood pressure, but I think the reality is in the world we're in that frequently patients are rushed into the room, a blood pressure is taken. If you looked at the new guidelines that talk about the systolic blood pressure of 120 and the diastolic blood pressure of 80 as a guideline for where blood pressure should be, those studies that they used to make those recommendations, patients were taken in a room. They sat them there for 5 minutes. They let them rest. They let them get comfortable. And then they took their blood pressures, again, with their arm resting and all of that involved. So I think blood pressures are really important, but I think most of the time we're not taking them correctly. And one of the things that I have my patients do is take their blood pressure at home when they're resting. And I talk about, you know, taking some time to be quiet and at rest and making sure your arm is resting when you're taking the blood pressure. So I think those are things that sometimes we get rushed around and are looking at numbers, and we forget that we need to take some time, let the patient rest before we check their blood pressure.
So what's the recommendation for the blood pressure? I know there was a 120 over 80 NIH address years ago, but considering most people's blood pressure goes up a little bit with age, what blood pressure gets you, a little bit worried or excited, or I got to recheck it? Is there what blood pressure for your adult patients?
So I think it depends on the population I'm looking at. If I'm looking at someone with diabetes or I'm looking at someone with renal disease, then I tend to want their blood pressure much better controlled. One of the things that I've seen from listening to experts is that a lot of my colleagues will look at a number and say, well, it needs to be 120 over 80. And so if a patient comes in who's healthy, who has a blood pressure of 135, for instance, over 80, they'll go, oh, you need treatment, when the guidelines actually give you a little bit of wiggle room in that 120 to 140 range of patients. So not everybody who has a blood pressure over 120 over 80 and higher needs to be on medication. Some of those patients, we can talk to them about lifestyle changes and monitor their blood pressure. Other patients with a lot of comorbidities, we really should be aiming for a blood pressure close to 120 over 80.
Okay, so you need your expert physician to help you out, give the guidance, and then you want the guidance that's generated for the masses, and you have to put it together and come back with add A, add B, and then decide on C. So that's my interpretation of being a good clinician that you've just espoused. So which services or medications are discouraged by the USPSTF, whatever
So that's the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force is what we're referring to. And they do not recommend vitamin, mineral, and multivitamin supplementation to prevent cardiovascular disease. So a lot of my patients take vitamin E and other supplements, and they do not find that that has actually been shown to be a benefit. And in some cases, it may actually be of harm. They do not recommend screening for for pancreatic cancer. They do not recommend ovarian cancer screening. They do not recommend hormone therapy in postmenopausal women for primary prevention of chronic conditions. Obviously, if you have hot flashes or some other condition that needs treatment, you may need to be on those medications. They do not recommend testing for genital herpes infections with serologic screening, so that's blood testing. They do not recommend thyroid or testicular cancer screening just routinely in everybody. They also recommend that we need to be careful about who we're doing the abdominal aortic aneurysm screening, and not everybody should be getting that. They recommend against asymptomatic screening for urinary tract infections. So if you don't have symptoms of burning or urinary frequency or other symptoms of a urinary tract infection, they do not recommend that we do a urine culture to find out what's going on. They don't recommend that we do screening for chronic obstructive pulmonary disease as well, and they do not recommend aspirin for primary prevention in cardiovascular disease.
So, Suzanne, I got to tell you, I argue with that aspirin business because, you know, my opinion is that the overall argument was that the patients, too many patients would get a GI bleed from their aspirin tablet. And my impression is if they had done enteric aspirin, such as a high-quality enteric aspirin, such as Ecotrin or Bayer enteric 81s, that they wouldn't have gotten those GI bleeds, and that there's a lot of people who have stroke history in their family and a lot of people have hypertension. You know, just I'm saying that as an individual physician, I would recommend they get, you know, a penny a day high-quality aspirin, and then the benefit from decreasing stroke and MI would be more favorable than the GI bleed risk. So I just want to, you know, give my opinion as that as a practicing physician, depends who you take care of, but you know, their guidelines and your individual physician interpretation, I think, is what the patient really wants.
And I think you see people who are more high risk and probably have underlying vascular disease as an endocrinologist. One of my areas of interest about 20 years ago was women's health. And when I looked at that data back at that time, it was interesting about how much women had an increased risk for bleeding with aspirin. So, you know, I had started recommending aspirin for my female patients, but after looking at a lot of the literature, I backed off a lot on aspirin prevention in primary prevention. Secondary prevention is a whole different story. If you have underlying vascular disease, then you definitely need to be on aspirin. But if you don't have underlying vascular disease, I think it's a little bit more challenging to know. And in women in particular, there were actually increased CNS bleeds and things like that. So I think it is a conversation you need to have with your doctor, and you know, so that, because again, you and I'm talking about population information. When a patient comes in to see us, they're an individual, and their risk and benefit doesn't necessarily match up with a whole slew when we're looking at an overall picture.
Gotcha. So I was just basically pushing on the fact that if you're going to take an aspirin, you should get a good aspirin and not one that's generic and that you don't know where it was made. But that's just my little comeback. But let me ask you the next question.
Yeah.
That drives me crazy is when people do urine analysis and CNSs. Do you have to give your patient any recommendations? Because I have so many people doing this start peeing, stop, and then pee again. Just curious how you're talking about, you know, how many false positives you can get, but what's your usual recommendation how to do a UA CNS?
So how to get the specimen is what you're referring to?
Yes.
I think one of the biggest problems I see is that patients, even when in my practice, my previous practice, we had a patient where we would specifically tell them how to collect the urine, and we would find pieces of toilet paper in the specimen sample. So the thing about if you're doing a urine for screening, not looking for infection, it's a different. If you're looking for microalbumin, for instance, you may not need to do the midstream catch. But if you're looking for infection, I think it's really, really important. So I tell my patients to wipe themselves really, really well. Obviously, we're talking about women in general because men don't have quite the same issue. But with women, I ask them to wipe themselves down really well. And then I tell them to start urinating and then stop and then collect the urine in the middle of their stream, then, you know, to retrieve the container and then urinate it and then finish urinating. So I do tell them to do a midstream clean catch.
Okay. So are these kind of preventive screening tests that USPSTF recommends, are they covered, or does someone have to put out, you know, cold cash for these things?
So it turns out that with the Affordable Care Act, any new health policy, so after 9/23/2010, preventative services with strong scientific evidence of benefit are covered, have to be covered by plans, and patients do not have to have a copay that they pay with those.
Okay, and you're saying that the patients, if they want to look that up, should go where?
So patients can go to www.healthcare.gov/preventative-care-adults, and it'll go through a list of things that are covered. And these are a list of the things that are typically covered. Again, they will have to check with their insurance, but these will particularly pertain to Medicare. So abdominal aortic aneurysm screening can be done one time. They will pay for alcohol misuse screening and counseling. They will pay for aspirin use. They will pay for blood pressure screening. They will pay for cholesterol screening, colorectal cancer screening from ages 45 to 75, depression screening, diabetes screening from ages 40 to 70, diet counseling for chronic diseases, fall prevention, hepatitis B and hepatitis C screening, HIV screening. They will also pay for PrEP or the pre-exposure prophylaxis for HIV, those medications. They'll pay for a number of immunizations. They'll pay for lung cancer screening, obesity screening, sexually transmitted infection prevention counseling, for statin prevention medications, for syphilis screening, for tobacco use screening, and for tuberculosis screening. Sorry.
I'm glad you have good lungs. That's all I can say. That's a lot of tests.
So
let me just switch. What about vaccines do you recommend for adults? Because that's a big deal coming up. And
mm-hmm.
Dr. Fallon thinks that it's a pain in the ass when they give people flu shots in August. So what vaccines are recommended for adults?
So they're recommending a flu shot every year for adults. The one thing about that is that if you're severely immune compromised, you should not get the live attenuated viral one, which is the flu mist or the one that they spray in the nose. So other than that, the influenza vaccine every year is recommended. They're recommending the Tdap, was the tetanus with the pertussis in it, and that one you should have once as an adult, and then you should have a booster of a TD, which is a tetanus, or the Tdap every 10 years. They're recommending if you are 65 years or younger that you consider getting an additional MMR, which is the measles, mumps, and rubella test. We do recommend, they are recommending Zoster or the what a lot of people call Shingrix now, and that is recommended that you get two doses after age 50. There are some changes with the HPV or Gardasil. HPV is human papillomavirus. That was recommended up to age 26 in adults. They are now suggesting that up to age 45, you have a discussion with your physician about whether you would benefit from the vaccine. So that's one of the newer recommendations. The pneumococcal vaccine is recommended in all patients over the age of 65, and there's been a big change in that. And the change in that is that we used to give the Pneumovax 13. They've now changed it to 15, which is called Vaxneuvance. And we also still are giving the Pneumovax 23. The big change, which I think is really easy for everybody, is that you can now give a Prevnar 20. So if you're over 65 and you haven't had a pneumococcal vaccine, just get the Prevnar 20. If you've had one of the pneumococcal vaccines, then talk to your doctor, because we used to give the 13 and the 23, and now it's switched to 15 and 23. So just make sure to check with your doctor where you are in that process. Then there are some other vaccines that are recommended for people who are in special categories, like the meningococcal vaccines, the hemophilus vaccines, and hepatitis A and hepatitis B vaccines.
So I just have to go back to my flu, because it's just one of my pet peeves, because basically flu doesn't come to the Philadelphia, New Jersey marketplace, you know, till actually mid-December usually. And usually the health department, if the flu comes early, will tell people. But there's no flu in August. There's no flu in September. So it takes about 2 weeks for those vaccines to take. So please put it closer to when that risk comes about. So that's just my preaching. My impression is the health department will tell everybody if the flu comes early. But that's just my opinion, because I hate when people get flu shots too early, because the question is, when the flu comes later in the winter months, you know, will they have enough immunity?
Yes.
Do you want to counter that at all? Because I just can't stand summer.
I tend to agree with you. I tend to order the tests. I tend to order the flu vaccine at the end of September or beginning of October. I don't like to get it a lot sooner because I do worry about the immunity waning. I will tell you that I have seen flu earlier and later in the last few years than ever before. And so, you know, I try to find the sweet spot. I know at Rowan we don't generally give the flu vaccine in August.
Thank God. So is there any other changes in the vaccine schedule that you want to talk about?
So the biggest one was the pneumonia vaccine. That's the pneumococcal vaccine. So that's the biggest change there. HPV, the human papillomavirus. Those are the two that have changed the most significantly, I think, in the last year.
Okay, and is there any patients who should not get vaccinated? Does that come up in your practice?
Yes, that does. So people who are severely immune compromised, people with HIV, people who are getting chemotherapy, really need to avoid anything that has a live attenuated virus. What that means is that they modify the virus genetically so it can't reproduce or replicate as fast, and it doesn't tend to cause illness in the average person, but it can cause illness in people who are immune compromised. So those vaccines are the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine, the live attenuated flu vaccine, smallpox, chickenpox, shingles vaccines, not the Shingrix, but the older shingles vaccine, or the varicella vaccine, and then some vaccines that people need for travel. So those should be avoided in people who are immune compromised. If you have had a severe anaphylactic reaction, obviously, or an allergic reaction, you should not take those vaccines again. The other thing to think about is people sometimes get Guillain-Barré after they have these vaccines. After some vaccines, those people really need to be careful about getting revaccinated. And I typically send someone like that to an infectious disease specialist to make sure that if I feel they might really need a vaccine, because I really want to have someone with expertise determine the benefit-risk ratio. There's a lot of controversy about whether you should get vaccines if you have egg allergies for some of these vaccines that may have egg protein in them, or egg-based vaccines. I really think that's something you should discuss with your physician, because that has been changing a lot recently. Anybody who gets really, really ill after a vaccine should consider not taking it. And then there's something called an arthritis reaction, which is basically a very red, indurated, large area around where you got the vaccine. And that typically only happens after you've gotten another dose. So it will be with your second dose of a vaccine or third dose. It can be seen with the tetanus vaccines. I do think I have seen it with the pneumococcal vaccines as well. And I know a lot of people with COVID are complaining about those types of reactions, but those seem to happen with their first vaccine, so that wouldn't really fit in this category of the arthritis reactions.
Okay.
But those are the main things you're looking for.
Yeah, okay. So basically what Dr. Schenk is saying is there's so much information here, so I think that's where podcasts come in. I just want to throw out her podcast where it's going to be, because for a lot of this data, you would want to personalize where her education is coming in. That's www.wwdbam.com. You go to Inside Medicine, and then you hit podcast. There's 120 shows up, but Susan will be up 2 hours after the show. And so if you have somebody who needs this information, you know, just redo the podcast, because the information's there, but a lot of information is being given out, and that's where podcasts come in. Let me just move forward, Susan, and thank you for all this information. How about prostate cancer screening? How come it's so controversial?
Well, I've been in practice for a long time, and I trained back in the early 1980s, and we tested everybody for prostate cancer with a PSA testing. What has happened is that there have been two large studies that have been done. One study was done in the U.S., and it basically didn't show any benefit in terms of preventing deaths from prostate cancer in the United States. There was a study that was done in Europe, which was a large study, and it did actually prevent some men from dying from cancer, but they had a lot of complications, and when the researchers looked at the data, they felt like it required a lot of patients and a lot of diagnoses to be able to actually prevent someone from dying from prostate cancer. So the recommendation for a while was not to test at all. Now the recommendation is that you sit and you have a conversation with your physician before you get prostate cancer testing done. Somebody once along the way told me at a conference, an expert said at a conference something that really helped me communicate to patients. And they said most of the time when we have prostate cancer, they're slow growing. And if you look at autopsies, you'll find people with it who didn't even know they had it. But the problem is that we're all worried about that fast-growing prostate cancer that metastasizes, and that's what we want to prevent. The problem is we don't really have a good screening test that tells us what kind of prostate cancer you have. We can tell you have prostate cancer, but we don't know if it's slow-growing. We don't know if it's going to be one of those aggressive types. So those are the issues that we have with the testing.
Yeah, the other problem is, you know, everybody talks about the physician's finger, but they have to realize that the prostate's got three dimensions. And if you can feel a bump on a prostate, that's the posterior section. But the anterior section, the doctor can't appreciate by, you know, a finger palpation. So you're doing a test that nobody really likes that much. And the other problem is that its ability to diagnose is poor. Now, of course, if you did everybody and you got somebody in the posterior, you're okay, but you hate to tell somebody going out the door, doctor, does that mean that I don't have prostate cancer? The answer is no, because basically there's an anterior and a posterior, and that's why when people get screened by urologists for a positivity, I mean, they do biopsies of the entire gland, which, of course, isn't fun, but I just want to make sure everybody knows that's why there's always... You don't get an A+. You ain't got no prostate cancer from a finger screening test. What about lung cancer screening? Do you recommend that, and who's supposed to get it?
I do recommend that. For a long time, we did not recommend it because we didn't have tests that were really helpful. Chest X-rays have never been shown to help, so that has been an issue with that. But recently, they've been able to show that low-dose CT scans of the chest can be really helpful in preventing people from dying from lung cancer. We could do chest X-rays, we could find you had lung cancer, but we didn't find it soon enough that we could prevent something. But we can do that now with these CAT scans. The recommendation is for patients between the age of 50 and 80, it is not recommended unless people have smoked at least a 20-pack year history of smoking. So that means a pack of cigarettes a day for 20 years or two packs a day for 10 years. It is also recommended only in patients who are currently smoking or who have quit within the last 15 years. They also recommend that you be of fairly good health. Obviously, if you're really, really sick, going through the whole process of being treated for lung cancer may not be appropriate.
So when you say low dose, that just means that the radiation has been limited on how much the CAT scan will give the patient.
Correct.
Got it. Okay. So moving forward, how about hepatitis C screening? I'm happy I'm older in terms of hepatitis C because that seems to be popping up.
So the recommendation is that we test everybody between age 18 and 79 at least once.
Okay.
Yeah.
That may
so
pick
I
up
thought
that
I wanted to
test.
Bring that up because that's interesting, I think.
Okay. So hepatitis C. So there's A, B, and C. So what makes C different than A and B?
Hepatitis C is one of those types of hepatitis that doesn't typically give people symptoms. So a lot of times the first time I recognize it is somebody might have a small abnormality of their liver enzymes on their blood test. That may be the only way I know it. And they estimate that 2.4 million people in this country have it, maybe even up to 4 million or so have a hepatitis C that's unrecognized. And there is a risk of cirrhosis and end-stage liver disease. There's also a risk of hepatic cancer or liver cancer. So we want to catch it. It is easily treatable nowadays with the new medications. We want to catch it and take care of it if we can.
Okay. How about an upgrade on mammogram guidelines?
The guidelines for mammograms are that we screen women every... So the mammogram recommendation is starting at age 50 and going to age 74 now. We used to start screening earlier. And again, when we're talking about mammograms, we're talking about average risk. So if you have high risk, this is not necessarily pertinent to you. But the recommendation is to do a mammogram every 2 years. We were doing it every year. That is one of the newer changes with the mammogram. There is some interesting data if you want to look on American College of Physicians. They looked at what the absolute reduction in cancer was for women getting screening mammograms. And what they found is between age 40 and 49, there may be three fewer women for 10,000 persons screened over 10 years in terms of reducing the death from breast cancer, which I thought was interesting. And the only age groups where it was statistically significant was between 50 and 69. And that in those groups, from 50 to 59, you see 8 fewer deaths, and from 60 to 69, you see 21 fewer. Between 70 and 74, they think there may be a reduction of 13 per 10,000 persons over 10 years. So those numbers were interesting to me to look at.
Gotcha. So just to put some vocabulary back here, what's the difference between mm-hmm. primary and secondary prevention?
So primary prevention is we're trying to treat you we're looking to see who's at risk of developing a condition and trying to prevent the onset of the condition. Secondary prevention means that you've already developed the disease and you may be symptomatic or not symptomatic, and then we're trying to prevent you from getting complications.
Got it. So cardiovascular disease is big in the U.S., and I kind of fight every day, not fight, I kind of talk to patients, you know, every day about their cholesterol data. Is there any recommendations to prevent cardiovascular disease for just about everybody, because it's just the number one killer? But recommendations for cardiovascular disease screening.
So for screening, that we do recommend lipid screening. I pair my lipid screening I do lipid screening, and then I do an ASCDV risk for so it's a cardiovascular risk tool that I use that looks at the risk that somebody has of developing heart disease or vascular disease over the next 10 years. And I pair those two together. We've talked about screening for hypertension. That's another thing that's really important. I personally feel like screening for diabetes is an important tool in terms of preventing vascular disease. Don't know what you think about that, but that's my personal opinion. And we talked a little bit about aspirin as well.
So what? Because cardiovascular disease is such a big deal here. What rings the bell that says, "Hey, I got to talk to the patient about potential cardiovascular risk" on your screening test?
On my screening test, well, anybody who has hypertension or diabetes, I'm going to be or is overweight, I'm going to be looking for cardiovascular disease. But I'm also, or screening for cardiovascular disease. But I'm also looking for people who have family history. I'm looking at people who smoke. I'm looking at patients who are sedentary now more than I ever did before. Those are the groups of people that I'm looking at on a regular basis to screen for cardiovascular disease. People who are on dialysis are much more likely to have disease. Anybody who has disease in one vessel of their body, if it's in their neck or their legs or their heart, are more likely to have disease in other vessels of their body. So if you already have vascular disease somewhere, I'm looking for it somewhere else.
So Susan, you do a lot of work in prevention, more than most internists. So what comes to the top for impactful preventive measures in your practice? Impactful.
Yes. So my husband's a cardiologist, and he and I were talking about this, and I asked him this question randomly after I had answered it for myself, and we both came up with a similar answer. And number one, and I don't know which is first or second, but the top two for both of us was regular exercise, and that includes aerobic exercise as well as strength training and flexibility or stretching, and the other one was smoking cessation for anybody who smokes or preventing people from starting to smoke. So those, I think, not only do they prevent cardiovascular disease, but they prevent a number of other conditions. I would add keeping your weight at a good level is really important too. What we're learning about gaining weight is that once you gain weight, it's very difficult to lose weight. So if I can get my patients to be active and eat healthy before their BMI is over 25, that's always, I think, a really, really good preventative tool in my practice.
I think that's fantastic, because the bottom line is nobody gets it, but once you put that weight on, your body's metabolic rate drops about 60%. So that's why it's easy to get it on. But once you, like you say, once you try and get it off with your metabolic rate slowing down, we're kind of like experiencing millions of years when if humans lost weight, they died, so that the metabolism was set. So don't lose weight. But we're in 2022 now, maybe 2023. And what I agree with you 100%. Once you gain that weight, it's tough, and that's why patients, hate to have that fight. And I'm sure that weight gain in your office, you're pushing for, don't get it. I love it. How about any other items you'd like to talk about? Because we have about 3 minutes left, and I just want to, anything else that you want to, tip off the patients?
Yes. There are a couple things. For cervical cancer screening, the guidelines have changed a little bit. They don't recommend starting until age 21. American Cancer for the U.S. Preventative Task Force and the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, They, for the American Cancer Society, they're recommending age 25 for starting screening, and they have switched from just regular pap smears to a process that's much more looking at HPV or human papilloma virus in testing, and that testing is somewhere between every 3 to 5 years now. So I would recommend that people look at that information, some of the websites we've recommended before, but just know that some of those things have changed in the last few years. And I think there are things that we don't talk about, like preventing gaining weight, which I think is really important. I also think that one of the things in my personal experience I've found is that we don't talk enough about patients putting their narcotics or pain medications somewhere safe. I cannot tell you how many patients, when I've had this conversation about putting your medicine someplace safe, have told me stories about people who came over to a party at their house and took their pain meds, or that they were in their bathroom and their kids found them and got hooked on them. So I think it's really, 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 really important to think about where you're putting things like benzodiazepines or narcotics or things that have risk of addiction or overdose for children, someplace where anybody can have access to them. So that's something I do spend time talking to patients about. I think we don't talk very much about concussion prevention, and I do think that's something we need to talk a lot more about. And so I think that's another thing that I find really, really helpful. I also was reading about how many deaths there are from drowning, so I really recommend that people who have pools in their backyard be really, really careful about children who have access to the pools, people who come in or have availability who may or may not know how to swim. It turns out a lot of Americans do not know how to swim, so I say be careful about that. I don't think we talk enough about seatbelts, but I think they make a huge, huge difference. And then I personally had a background in working with patients who had addiction problems, and so I think we really need to be talking more about smoking cessation, alcohol abuse, and drug abuse.
So, Suzanne, you've got great communication skills, great personality, very, very comprehensive. Do you want to tell anybody how they can get in touch with you at Rowan if they would like to have your services?
Thank you, Joe. It's a pleasure working with you. It's been fun getting to know you at Rowan, and you're a great physician. Anybody who wants to get in touch with me or the primary care physicians I work with at Rowan should call 856-566-7070.
Suzanne Shank, fantastic internist, tip-top, and all I can say is I recommend her highly. Her podcast will be up. She gave a lot of data. www.wwdbam.com. In 2 hours, we'll have it up for people who need to check out her information that she provided for the Philadelphia, New Jersey marketplace. Thank you, Suzanne. We'll be back next week. Joe Fallon signing off.